Last week, I dealt with issues mainly having to do with the relationship of law and society and social changes to society that have created social disunity and therefore problems with crime. This week, I wanted to deal more with approaches to understanding how we might be able to deal with crime problems within the context of American society. It's kind of like last week we were going up the hill to the summit. I hope this week is kind of coming downhill and maybe going home looking for new directions. It was suggested last week that I might put some topics on or use the blackboard a little bit so that people would know where we're going. There's a tendency to get sidetracked or digress in one direction or another, and then not to be able to get to some of the things that I think might be important. I don't want this topic list to limit you. You know, it'd be nice if we could have the best of both worlds. So I put these topics up there to sort of keep my own direction somewhat consistent. But feel free to jump in whenever you want to. I told the people last week that I've tried to set these sessions up so that the issues that we would be dealing with would be dealt with in such a way that you might feel them yourself as something that you've been wondering about or something that plagues you, a problem that you yourself have some indeterminacy about. In other words, we see problems and we see how we deal with them, but we tend to think, well, maybe these ways of dealing with them don't work too well. Why don't they work so well, and what can we do? So I've tried to, as I said, gear these sessions so that question might come up to you or with you. So today it's approaches to dealing with the crime problem, looking at social approaches to deal with it, or society-wide approaches. Tomorrow I want to deal with individual approaches. Now, the first distinction I wanted to make is between crime and criminality. This is something that a lot of us may not think about, but it influences the possibilities of the kinds of legislation, whether it'll work or not in dealing with some of these problems. If we're dealing with crime, and if we think about it this way, do we want to reduce crime in our society or do we want to reduce criminality? And what that means is, when we're talking about crime, we're talking about like counting numbers of crimes that are committed. You know, like how many crimes are reported to the police, how many crimes are cleared by arrest, those types of things. When we're talking about criminality, we're talking about criminals. And in other words, counting the number of criminals. Now, the approach can be to reduce the number of criminals, the number of people who commit crimes, or the approach can be to reduce crime, the number of crimes in society. Now, where this becomes important is that when we think about the relationship between crime and criminality, it's possible to reduce crime, the number of crimes, and that will have obviously an influence in reducing the number of criminals in society. But it's not clear that the other way around works equally as well. In other words, reducing the number of criminals hasn't in the past seemed to have stemmed the tide of crime. In other words, the more we aim programs at discovering, arresting, convicting, incarcerating criminals, it doesn't seem to have too much of an influence on the overall gross number or amount of crime that we have in our society. The criminality approach is based on the them versus us kind of thing. That there's those criminals out there and then there's us good guys. And we have to find out who they are. And in most of this century, the study of criminality the study of crime has been based on the study of criminality. In other words, go out and study those people, find out what makes them different from the rest of us. And whether it's personality, characteristics, whether it's social background characteristics, nutritional differences, biological differences. In other words, you'd have a class of people who are not criminals and a class of people who are criminals, and you study both of them, compare them, find out what makes them different. It seems that that's been based on a lot of false assumptions, that approach. For one thing, how can you make a distinction between criminals and non-criminals? Is it possible to find people who really have never committed a crime? What happens mostly is that the criminologist goes into a prison, and there you've got a nice group of criminals. Well, you see, you've really skewed the study to begin with then, because you're studying those people that are incarcerated rather than criminals as a class. And so it may be that the major difference is that these are the people that have been arrested and incarcerated. That's the difference between criminals and non-criminals. But can you draw a line, you know, and divide the groups one side and the other? It seems pretty fruitless to do that. The crime approach, or the approach to studying crime then, and how we can reduce crime, goes away from the individual, the emphasis on the individual and what makes this individual different, or what's sometimes called the person blame approach, you know, finding who is responsible, arresting that person, convicting, incarcerating that person. That's what the criminal justice system approach is. The crime approach, though, looks at how the society fits together in such a way as to produce a particular volume of crime, and then how we can manipulate that structure so that the amount of crime might be reduced. And this has to do with a systems approach. A systems approach looks at how the individual, or how people interact within a system of other influences. Or let me use a couple examples. When when an airplane crashes, the Federal Aeronautics Administration comes out and investigates the reasons for the crash. Now, it used to be that what they would try to find is, you know, what did this pilot do to cause that plane to crash? Or what did the pilot fail to do? Or, you know, what was wrong with the airplane? Was there some mechanical failure? Something like that. And they didn't really make too much headway in preventing accidents until they started to develop and use a systems approach. In other words, how the pilot interacts with the airplane machinery to produce the accident. So let's say that the airplane is landing and the pilot reaches for some instrument, some toggle switch or something, and flips it. And instead of feathering the props, it retracts the landing gear, something like that. So the plane crashes. Well, the old approach would say, well, that pilot made a mistake. That's the reason that plane crashed. The systems approach says, how can we redesign that instrument panel so that that kind of thing won't happen again? Another analogy is from medicine and the triumph of medicine in this century over acute illnesses. You think about polio, for example, which used to plague our society, most societies, I suppose. The approach, the person blame approach, to continue the analogy, would be to find out, well, this is caused by this particular virus, and so if we're going to eliminate polio, we got to go around and find all those little viruses, and we have to eliminate them, which would be an endless task. A systems approach would see how the physiology interacts with that virus to produce the illness, and therefore how we can, the answer, of course, is to inject some of the polio into the person, even dead cells, and build up an immunity to the illness. So, medical science wouldn't have gotten very far if it used the virus blame approach. it wouldn't have been able to conquer these illnesses. But the approach, the other side of it then, comes in and sees how the elements in the system interact to produce the undesirable effect. Now, another problem with the person blame approach is that when we discover differences, we think we've discovered differences between criminals and non-criminals, what does it say about what we should do? Let's say we discover that criminals come from broken homes, or homes of alcoholic parents, or homes where there's poverty. These are sort of favorite explanations. popular explanations. Or that they're biological throwbacks. Or that they have some physiological problem. So we discover these things. Now that, once we've discovered these differences, then what does it say what we should do about preventing these people from committing further crimes? There's only really a few answers. We can kill them. I said, well, to go back a little bit, we had an interruption there. To go back, let's say we you know, do these studies and we find what these differences are between the criminals and non-criminals. And let's say we discover things like the criminals, you know, these favorite explanations, broken homes, drunkenness, poverty, biological intelligence problems, all of those different things. Once we've discovered those things, what does it say about reducing criminality? We only have certain choices. We can kill them, incarcerate them for the rest of their lives, or do some kind of psychosurgery or something like that. Because we can't change those elements in their background. They're there forever. So, again, it puts us up against a wall. You know, we've discovered these differences, and people say, well, these differences don't go away. They still have the potential for recommitting crimes. Why do we let them out in society? And here again, I think we've been influenced in the last few decades by what's called an over-socialized conception of humans, that humans are simply products of their environment, and that's about it. And what we have to do to correct that is see that individuals can, in their own context, act as causes of their own behavior, in other words, choices. And to predict an individual choice, like this person will commit that crime, is in theory impossible. There's no way to predict an individual act like that. We can predict to the extent that there's an absence of human freedom. You know, a complete absence would probably entail complete prediction. It's like having a rat, you know, in a maze or in some other kind of psychological experiment where all extraneous variables are eliminated. If you could get humans in that kind of a situation where they had no freedom of choice, then we would be able to predict their behavior. But that's difficult to do. Humans have this tremendous ability to transcend those circumstances and to avoid those kinds of controls. I'll never forget this cartoon where these two rats are in this sort of a maze-like thing, and there's a researcher in a white coat that's looking at them, and one rat says to the other one, "Well, we finally got that guy trained to give us a piece of food when we press that bar." And you know, so it's the conception that people have to rise and transcend their circumstances that don't allow us to be able to have this kind of complete prediction. We can predict, you know, as long as there's routine, we can make those kinds of predictions. Or like the cafeteria over here can predict, you know, how many people are going to come to dinner, how much food they have to buy, you know, and those kinds of things. Toll takers or you know, people that plan for traffic. Know that there's going to be more traffic at certain hours than other traffic, so they make those kinds of adaptations to their systems. But in terms of predicting that individual is going to go out of prison and commit a crime or not commit a crime is, in essence, is impossible to predict. So what I'm saying is that it's better to use a systems approach or to focus on crime when we're using social approaches. To reducing the amount of crime. Let me basically say that a society gets the kind of crime that it deserves. And what I mean by that is that the characteristics of a society produce a certain amount and kind of crime. Look at Holden Village, for example. I don't know whether you felt this way, but did you notice that there's not a lot of locks on doors around here, or a lot of keys? I don't know whether that affected you the first day you were here or not. You know, you go walking out of your room, and you're going to leave your valuables in the room, and you think, where's that lock? Where's the key? You know, there's a lock on my door, but there's no key. So I could lock myself out, I suppose. But so I was talking to someone the other night who is on the staff here, and they said, well, later on in the summer and even into the fall when a lot of elderly people come up here, you see all these women carrying around clutching their purses to them, you know, because they're nervous at first about leaving things in their rooms. But you think about the community life here. And after you're here for a while, you see it really doesn't make a lot of sense to lock your door. I mean, there's really not a lot of need for it. Besides, if you take something, where are they going to go? the group here or the community is small enough that we can keep eyes on one another. Or, you know, we know who comes and goes. And you don't have the kind of situation that's conducive to crime then. But now if you look at American society, the hallmark of American society is individualism. Especially since World War II, we've had this ethic of success. After World War II, there was this optimism. America, we're on the top of the world. We can improve our society. Everybody can be successful. And so individual success becomes an ethic that is very strong in our society. And it may be why a lot of people immigrate. Maybe most people immigrate to this society because we hold this candle out to the world, individual success. You know, you can leave your families, you can leave your communities, you can leave your countries, you can leave all of these social entities that bind a person, and you can come to the United States and make big dough and then send it back home, bring your relatives over here. One fellow in my ride group is from, digress for a second, is from Nigeria. And he came over here on a scholarship to Berea College. And he discovered when he got over here that there's all kinds of money available for people like him to go to school. So he started writing away for scholarships and everything like crazy. He got so much money, he started sending it back home and brought his brothers over here. But he sees this country as not his home. You know, it's a place to make a success in order to go back home and live a lot better off than he did. And so the success or the individual success ethic leaves us with and also does not promote this we feeling or our commitment to the social situation and preserving family life, neighborhood life, and so on that is necessary to make our society more like Holden Village in terms of having a low rate of crime. It goes further. I said, you know, like everybody's supposed to be a success. But you see how impossible that is. Because you need failures to have successes. And the more successes you have, the more failures we'll have too. And it goes hand in hand. I was reminded of that last night at Vespers, listening to Dan Erlander's sermon. You know, the idea of keeping points. The more we keep points, the more losers we have. You know, so the rest of the world looks at us and they say, boy, in that country they have more millionaires than any other country in the United States. We also have more failures than most other countries in the United States too, especially countries that are at the same level of economic development as we are. We have these kinds of, when it comes to helping people in our society, we see these contradictions. If you go to a medical school, let's say, and you see a black student or some other type of student that you wouldn't normally expect to see there, maybe a woman, although these kinds of things are changing, you say to yourself, oh, I'll bet that person didn't get there on their own merit. I'll bet it was some kind of a quota system or maybe special scholarships for minorities or whatever. So that person's success is less deserved. They didn't do it on their own. And you know, these old American success stories, I started out with nothing, but look where I am today. And so the contradiction is that we reward the very things that promote crime, in that we promote a person's ability to leave the various social situations that would impinge on them or prevent them from going their own way. And since World War II, we've done this to much greater extent. The lax divorce laws, for example, the ability of people to leave jobs and to move, the mobility of people. It produces these strange kinds of neighborhood situations where people can live in a place for years and not know their neighbors. And people can keep busy all the time. One sociologist has put it this way: what we promote is people becoming kinder to strangers and strangers to their own kind. And you see, the breakdown of the old communal societies or the colonial communities in early America was pretty much due to the desires of commerce and business to expand out beyond the community. And you know, Americans, it's funny when you talk to people that come over from other countries and they say, well, are Americans very friendly? And they say, on the surface, they're extremely friendly. You know, they're, hello, how are you? You know, and they meet you and all that stuff, but they don't invite you into their homes very much. They don't invite you into their personal life. Whereas you talk to Americans that hitchhike or travel in other countries, and you hear these stories about, you know, it's difficult to get people to know people just on the spur of the moment or in the street. But if you do get to know a person, they tend to invite you into their home, you know, take care of you, let you stay there for a year if you want to, something like that. Let's see. Well, I mentioned this last week too, that to the extent that we produce or we promote this individualism, then the problems of taking care of children or the problems of taking care of the elderly, or in this case, the problems of taking care of crime, fall to something else. And what is that something else? Government, sometimes put government. And so because of the breakdown in these traditional ways of handling community and social growth and so on, we have government stepping in and doing it. And it influences then the meaning of freedom that we have. And this is something that we talked a little bit about last week too. The founders of this country were afraid of government. They didn't want government interfering with their lives. They wanted communities that were self-contained, that would take care of their own problems. And so we developed a government in the Constitution of the United States, a very weak federal government, so that it would not influence or attempt to influence the goings-on in smaller communities. That was the kind of freedom people wanted. But if you've ever been raised in a small town, or if you've ever lived in Holden Village for very long, you notice that that's really a different kind. It's a loss of freedom, in a way, because you have people more interested in your life, you know, and horning in on your life, and controlling you, and knowing all your business, those kinds of things. And this is abhorrent to some people. You know, the city then is something that's much different than that, where people lead these isolated, lonely sometimes existences. But then, since World War II, we've developed this different meaning of freedom, individual freedom, freedom from this kind of small town control, where we go our own ways and promote our own interests, which leads to then a bigger government and more government influences in social life. And the way that government handles the crime problem is with the criminal justice system. And the expansion of the criminal justice system has been tremendous in recent years. Increasing numbers of police, probation officers, prison officials, kinds of rehabilitation programs, courts, judges, and sometimes lawyers. And so, like the expansion of other kinds of social services. Now, the criminal justice system is based on the deterrence model. In other words, the criminal justice system is supposed to prevent crime by applying the deterrence model. Now, the deterrence model is a pretty simple theory. It's kind of what parents do when they catch their kids doing something wrong. Swift, sure, and severe punishment. And to the extent that those three elements are promoted, then wrongdoing will likely be prevented or reduced. So swift means that as soon as the punishment, you know, the closer you can get the punishment to the act, the better it is. If there's a long wait, or, you know, several days later, you know, the parent comes in and says, remember last week when you did something wrong, I'm going to punish you for that now. It has less meaning. Sure means that it's likely or it's necessary that as many people or persons who commit the wrongdoing be punished. In other words, you can't have a lot of people committing wrongdoing or crimes and not be punished, or else it hurts and prevents the deterrence model from working. And then severity. The punishment has to be strong enough so that people take into account and weigh the possibilities that and decide that they're not going to do this particular thing because of the severity of the punishment. Now, why doesn't the deterrence model work? The basic paradox is that the more you have to use it, the less likely it's going to work. You know, you think about this with raising children or disciplining employees or in any other kind of superordinate, subordinate situation like that. The best punishment is the threat. You know, if you have to use it, it's kind of a loss then. You don't want to use it. You don't want to use your ultimate weapons, in other words, because then you haven't got anything left. You want to use them as rarely as possible so that each time you use them, it's a big deal. In other words, it's really important. If you use them all the time, then they don't become so important any longer. They're a part of routine or everyday life. So the criminal justice system can't work the more that it's used. Now, another way of looking at this is to look at the swift, certain, or sure. I remember it with three S's, swift, sure, severe. They're like the poles of magnets, you know, the positive poles of magnets. You try to push them together, and the more you push them together, the more they spring apart. They mutually contradict one another. In other words, the more swift justice is, the less sure it is. In other words, the more mistakes that are going to be made. You see, the more sureness there is, the less severe, or excuse me, the less swift, right? The less swift punishment is going to be, because you want to be careful of each case, as we've tended to in recent years with promoting due process. And then you see, justice isn't so swift. People languish for long periods of time in jails before they come to trial, or it's possible to put off within court the ultimate decisions or confrontations. And then it also works with severity. The more severe you make the penalties, the less sure punishment becomes. Because juries or judges aren't going to apply severe penalties unless they're sure. You know, the quickest way, you know, what happens in our system now is that it depends quite a bit for its efficiency. We have such a clog in the system of cases that it depends so much on what's called plea bargaining or bargain justice, where the defendant pleads guilty in exchange for considerations, usually a reduction in the crime with which the person is charged. So what happens when severe penalties are attached to crimes that are particularly bothersome is that all of a sudden you find nobody convicted of those crimes anymore. You find them convicted of lesser offenses. A few years ago when the state of New York decided to apply the death penalty for drug pushing, all of a sudden nobody was convicted of drug pushing anymore. Because you're not going to get some 14-year-old kid up there and, you know, give him the death penalty. or it turns out that the social context in which drug pushing takes place is a sort of a normal everyday activity, and it seems kind of strange to apply the death penalty to it. This would be likely for other crimes too, like rape. The more severe penalties we put on rape, the less convictions we're likely to get, unless we tie the hands of criminal justice officials one way or another. But then there's other adaptations that are made in the system. For example, with drunk driving, if we pass laws that make it mandatory to go to jail for drunk driving on a first offense, if that's all we did, then there wouldn't be very many people convicted of drunk driving. And then if we added time to the sentence, there'd be even fewer people. But if we make it some kind of a mandatory sentence, then we get jails filled up with people, and then they get let out of jail earlier, or something else, you know, in terms of trying to maintain the efficiency in the system. So the ethic for the criminal justice system, the more we use it, becomes efficiency. And efficiency in our system means pretty much plea bargaining, pushing us through as many cases as possible within the shortest period of time. Do you have any comments or questions about that? Or do you understand that? The way to make the criminal justice system effective, then, is to apply the deterrence model the way it should. In other words, what happens if there's a crime committed in the community and it's rare that this kind of crime takes place, or it's rare that a crime takes place? Then it's a big deal, and everybody pays attention to it. And all of those elements, swiftness, surety, and severity, can be applied. We have such a volume of crime then, and because we tend to lay the responsibility for it on the criminal justice system, that you notice how crime has become so routine in our society. If your house is broken into or your car is broken into, somebody takes something, you call the police, you don't really have an expectation the police are going to solve the problem. In fact, you probably wouldn't even call the police in most circumstances unless you had insurance. And you need to report the crime to get the insurance company to come through and replace whatever it was. Juvenile vandalism, you know, pretty much the same way. Most of these crimes aren't even reported to the police, because they're just so common and everyday. And then the police tend to take a lot of these things less seriously too. They don't have a lot of time to deal with some of these things. They tell people to deal with it on their own, maybe, which is would be a good idea if they even did more of that. But you see how, for example, somebody's having a loud party or dogs are barking, you know, those kinds of things. People call the police within our fractured neighborhoods and communities because they don't know their neighbors, or they don't feel they can approach their neighbors. Or like I was talking to a guy the other day, or not the other day, last year, as a matter of fact, and he said that he worked during the day as a writer, and he worked in his backyard. He had a little house back there that he worked in, and he said there was this barking dog, just barked all day, and he couldn't concentrate. So he finally went over to the house, and this woman answered, and she was very shy, and she was a bit embarrassed, and she said, well, she talked to her husband about it, and why didn't he come back when her husband was home? So he did. He came back that evening, and her husband happened to be some Hell's Angel, beard, long hair, big pesky guy with tattoos all over his body. Told the guy to get lost. I think, you know, that people fear that kind of confrontation if they don't call the police. Well, the challenge then for us is, how can we make the American way of life, maybe putting it another way, how can we make democracy compatible with crime controls? Do people want their freedom limited? Do we want something like a national ID card system? In Japan, there's a lot of issues I could bring up with, in relationship to this, but it's interesting in Japan how, with their traditions, they consider their authorities in a different light. The police department, for example, is much more revered than in our society. Our society, the police have a lot of difficulty controlling people, even law-abiding citizens. People don't want police intervening in their life. So the police know this too. They know how difficult it is to ask Joe Average or Jane Average citizen to do anything. I was reading a book one time written by a sociologist who had studied the police in Britain and the United States, and he gave an example to show the difference. He said in London, where he was studying, when this constable was telling him that sometimes married couples, if they got in a big argument and it started to get physical, would come down to the constable's office and ask the constable to help them settle their dispute. That wouldn't happen in the United States. In fact, that's one of the ways the police most often get injured, is answering disturbance calls like that. The couple turn the focus of their attention on the police officer and start taking out their frustrations on him. Well, he said, then he came to the United States and this guy was an Englishman, and he was studying the police here, and he said that one night in this department he was studying, there was a big rainstorm, and there was a underpass that was flooded. And so the police officer went out there and was standing in the rain telling the people to go around. And so he'd stand out there and try to flag the people down, and they go right through. And he got so frustrated that finally he said, "I don't care." And he just got in his car and just sat there waited for the people to go into the water and call for a tow truck. But in Japan, where they have this much more of a tradition of authority within their systems, which we don't have in our society, the police officer, the patrol officer, horns in on people's lives as a part of his business. In other words, he goes around and knocks on doors and asks people what the problems are in the neighborhood, what kinds of family problems they're having, whether they're having any problems dealing with their children, those kinds of things. He keeps extensive notes on these types of things. He keeps track of what everybody's doing in that particular jurisdiction in which he's patrolling. I had a Japanese student a couple of years ago, and I talked to him a lot about it. Remember when, I don't know if this is still true, Americans had this great love affair with the way Japanese were doing some things because their automobiles were so great and their TV sets, they must really be doing something right. So I was asking him about these things, and America, to institute some of these things in American society would probably be impossible because Americans would find it so oppressive. But he was telling me that his brother was a police officer in a town called Sapporo. And I said, "Oh yeah, what's he doing?" And he says, "Well, he just started out. He has the lowest level job there is." And I said, "Oh really, what's that?" And he says, "He follows around communists." And I said, "Oh," and you know, I was thinking, you know, it's kind of the opposite of our society. The top level job is the patrolman, you know, that goes around and keeps track of what everybody's doing. In our society, it's sort of the reverse. The bottom level job is the patrolman who has to go out there and face the wrath of the average citizen, and then the person works their way up into investigation to get out of that and follow around communists. And it really shows a difference in the social structure of the society. Well, back to the issue then of democracy and crime control. What can we do? What kinds of things can we do to promote community, or the kinds of things that would reduce crime and at the same time preserve the values that we feel are important or dear to us? One of the things we have to start realizing is, and I think this is happening to some extent, I think the pendulum is going back the other way, that there needs to be some kind of fundamental changes in our society. Now, I don't mean drastic changes. There's drastic ways of reducing crime. War, for example, reduces crime. And depressions, economic depressions, reduce crime. I don't think we want those kinds of ways of reducing crime. Higher crime rates go along with economic development. And you really have to ask ourselves, how much of that would we be willing to forego in order to reduce crime? In other words, you can look at third world countries that have low crime rates, And it doesn't take a sociologist to predict what's going to happen to those crime rates as those societies develop and as their traditional ways of organization break down. In other words, higher crime rates go along with higher standards of living. Higher crime rates go along with longevity, a longer lifespan. Crime rates, in other words, keep pace with these types of things. But I think we have more than we want in our society anyway. I think we'd be able to put up with a little less crime. So we have to start thinking about fundamental changes. And what I mean is kinds of changes that are very small and don't seem to be very important, but over time they do represent large changes. I'm thinking of, you know, something like an alarm clock. It, you know, on wind-up alarm clocks, there's the thing on the back for the slow-fast adjustment. And the drastic change is, you know, your alarm clock's going a little slow, so you flip it way over. And then, you know, the next day you notice it's going too fast, so you flip it way back the other way. That's kind of the way we as Americans think about doing things. We want things to happen right now. We don't want to wait. If our programs aren't successful, or if they're only successful in a minor way in reducing crime, we think they don't work. What I'm talking about is where you make a small adjustment, that maybe, you know, a change in a few seconds or a second per hour, but over a long period of time, this means a fundamental change. So, you know, like maybe a social goal would be reducing the divorce rate by maybe a tenth of a percent per year for a while. And you see, over that isn't very much. And the programs that would do that would not seem to be successful on the surface right away. But the kinds of things that I think we are developing in our society at these times have those kinds of goals of small changes that over time will mean fundamental differences. Or reducing the unemployment rate by just a little bit per year. And then over a long period of time, it may mean more stability in employee-employer relationships. You see, the price we pay for not having these stable relationships in families, in the employment place, or in neighborhoods. Employers have to put up with, if you are an employer, you know how this is, if you have a constant changeover in personnel or employees. If you get somebody that's really good in a position, then the ethic of individualism means that they want to move on and they want to, you know, maybe get their own business, or they want to move to another job that has more status or salary or prestige. To what extent would we be willing to forego those changes in order to stabilize neighborhoods and communities? Think about things that people can do on their own in terms of building neighborhoods. There has to be goals, neighborhood goals. Maybe you live in a neighborhood that's real tight, you know, and you know the people there. Most of this happens when people have children, because the children form the bridges between families. This happened to me. When my children were real young, I was able to maintain some insulation from my neighbors, but after a little while you start finding all these little kids running around your house that you don't know. You find out who they are and where they come from, and all of a sudden bridges are starting to be built. But that's in terms of like child care and keeping surveillance over children. But there's a lot of other things neighborhoods can do. If you notice, like in suburban communities, the individualism, in one sense, means that we all have our own little individual appliances, lawn tools, and those kinds of things, only even though we only use them rarely. You know, think in terms of sharing these types of things, tools and so on, within a neighborhood, those kinds of possibilities. Buying groceries. There was a group here last week from Gig Harbor and Washington, and they were saying that they have, you know, grocery cooperatives, some that they are involved in. You notice how that binds people together. All of these things mean that people are going to have to think twice about moving. you know, and establishing themselves in another place. If you're getting all these benefits and from the community in which you live, you think, well, maybe I don't want to take that job in Poughkeepsie, you know, or something like that, because I have, you know, here it's more beneficial to me and my family. Some other possibilities, you know, these kinds of things could grow into having loan cooperatives, which happens some, you know, in employment situations to some extent, but you don't think about these things in neighborhood contexts. Or neighborhood family counseling. The beginnings, the practical kinds of cooperation lead into naturally, I think, over time, these more psycho-emotional possibilities, or the greater, larger kinds of practical concerns. Neighborhood watch programs are things that are ways to start kinds of neighborhood cooperation. There's a program in Detroit that's been very successful working in the slums, and the poverty sections of towns. These are the hardest communities to develop cooperation in, because people are scared in those communities, and so they organize themselves into small groups like families, and they don't want to be outside. They don't want to have contact with the rest of those neighborhoods, because there's rapacious people that run around and create problems. But in Detroit, the police chief there, his name is Hart, started a program where police officers, like a couple police officers in this neighborhood program, will go knock on the doors of people who live in their area and tell them about a program and ask them if they want to participate. And then, in order to ensure cooperation, the police department will not institute these programs unless over 50% of the people in the neighborhood decide that they want to participate in it. So then the people get together and they have a meeting, and the police officers take up an office in the neighborhood, like maybe in a basement of a church. And the officers are wearing, you know, sport coats and ties. They're not in uniform. But what they're trying to promote is to some extent, is this Japanese model, where the people start looking to the police as a way of organizing and taking care of some of the problems in their communities. There's examples other places where police departments are beginning to throw parties or barbecues or whatever for people within an area, for them to get to know one another. The biggest block to leaving this up to the criminal justice system, in other words, the biggest block to getting away from that, is the criminal justice system itself. Because, let's face it, they make their money off, they make their living off this kind of thing. And if crime is reduced, then there's less work for the criminal justice system. And what happens oftentimes is, as crime is reduced, then it's necessary to focus on other areas that maybe police departments or prosecutors didn't deal with before. In other words, if there's a lot of serious crime going on, they can't deal with a lot of lightweight crime because there just isn't time. When you start dealing with serious crime, or if that's reduced, then oftentimes you find elements of the criminal justice system moving into other areas that they weren't in before, like knocking on your door with some kind of a warrant for your arrest for not paying your parking tickets. Or traffic violations, or prostitution, public drunkenness, these types of things. Over half the arrests in the United States every year are for drunkenness-related offenses, which are public offenses. And so when the criminal justice system finds itself with not a lot of work to do, it starts going into these areas that are these kinds of crimes that are public offenses. In other words, ones that people commit in public, so they're easy to see and fine. It's more difficult dealing with private or secret types of crimes. One of the ways to do this, of course, to reduce the extent to which the criminal justice system might want to intrude in our lives, is to make them feel more wanted. In other words, it's like, you know, I think it's somewhat analogous to the military. if you shower all kinds of benefits on the military, you know, early retirement, big pensions and those kinds of things, they aren't going to want to go out and commit wars, because they already feel needed, you know, and necessary, and we treat them well. If the criminal justice system, the military, feels that they're unwanted or they're not necessary or that we don't like them, then they're going to try to prove to us how they are necessary, and by doing their job even harder. and you see where communities, you find ghettos and slums where there's this antagonistic relationship between the police and the community, or the criminal justice system in the community. There's a tendency then for the police to try to prove how much they're needed. The community then rejects that, and you start seeing this antagonism starting to develop. Whereas if the bridges are made to the community and the people start appreciating the police and showing the police that they appreciate them, then there's more cooperation and less incidences and less antagonism. As I said, these approaches, some kinds of legal changes. I think it's necessary for us to get morals offenses out of the criminal justice system. They clog it too much, and the criminal justice system can't deal with those, and they never have been able to. Some sins are not crimes, and we have to realize that. And to the extent that, especially business-related vices, like prostitution and drugs and so on, the more we deal with those problems with the criminal justice system, the bigger those problems grow. In other words, the more money we throw at dealing with them through the criminal justice system, the bigger the problem appears to become. It's like the response to the problem and the perpetrators or the problem itself are looking at each other in a mirror. In other words, so the bigger that the approach comes to the problem, the bigger the image of the problem appears to be. And this has been borne out in recent times, especially in the way we deal with drugs. We don't seem to have been able to make any headway. What we do is drive up the prices of drugs, and we make it more lucrative for people to go into the trade. We can't stem the flow of drugs to this country. Drugs are necessary to American society at this stage of its development. How could we get by without drugs of one sort or another? Most of us, I suppose there's hardly anybody here that doesn't depend one way or another on certain kinds of drugs. Our society makes a distinction, as the medieval church did, between holy and unholy drugs. It's like the difference between holy water and unholy water. They're the same, you know, H2O, they're the same formula, but they symbolize something very different. So we think about opiate drugs or heroin. It symbolizes something to us. It gets us all upset. It's like the Bible in Russia. You know, can you imagine anything so stupid as what the Russians do about the Bible, you know, not allowing it into their country? They create the situation where people want to then smuggle it in. In Albania, it's the death penalty for baptizing somebody. Doesn't that seem strange? Well, that's not any stranger than the way we handle drugs. Not at all. You know, Sigmund Freud was a heroin addict. He was also a cocaine addict. People use drugs because they think it enhances, especially in our society, their achievement possibilities. And then when they find that they're a success, they don't need the drug anymore. Or maybe it helps them cope with their daily living because they don't want to change their situation. So, and these are whatever these kinds of drugs are. In our attempt to then say, well, somehow pharmacologically or scientifically this drug is evil and this one isn't, is stupid. It doesn't make any sense, and it creates all kinds of law enforcement problems. There's probably never been such a corrupt agency in government than the Drug Enforcement Administration, because the huge amounts of money that are involved. The drug trade in this country finances revolutions around the world. now, you know, I just read in the paper, I don't know if it's true or just something to get us excited, that Nicaragua or El Salvador rebels are involved in exporting drugs to this country as a way of financing their revolution. But that's what went on in Southeast Asia too. We have this incredible market for this. We go to all this Mexican opium that comes into this country. I was talking to a vice squad officer in Oakland last year, and he said since he'd been working in drug enforcement for a long time, and he said, you know, he says, this year is the first time I've ever seen the price of heroin go down, because there's just so much, and they're giving it away, you know. It's so lucrative. And then so we go to Mexico and we say, hey, look what you're doing to our country, you're poisoning our country. Well, we're the market for that. It's a lot like Mexican vegetables. Mexico, 2 years ago, for the first time, has had to import beans and rice in its history. And the reason for that is because they've turned their cropland over to tomatoes, you know, winter fruit, to export to this country. And it's like that with drugs too. So we create these huge markets, and the problem just grows. Prostitution is as basic to business in our society as probably alcohol is basic to business. We had a secretary in our department a few years ago who had worked in San Francisco in the Australian consulate, and she said every year a guy would come through there and tell the secretaries that if they reserved one evening where he could call them for to be part of his escort service for visiting businessmen, he would pay them $400 a week, or excuse me, $400 a month, $100 a week. And they didn't even have to have a date. All they, you know, just had to be available. And, you know, there's a lot of money for these kinds of things. And most of prostitution, probably, you know, like 9/10 of it, is underground. That kind of thing, where women are moonlighting in the business to enhance their incomes. But when we crack down on the problem, who do we crack down on? We crack down on the visible tip of the iceberg, the streetwalker. And they're the ones that suffer for the entire institution. Likewise with illegal drugs, when we crack down, we get the powerless, generally powerless person that's involved. There's hardly any time left. I could go on with some of these some more possibilities, but do you have any response or do you have any experience that you'd want to relate?
Yeah, I would take exception to a number of things that you said.
All right.
One of the things, in all of us, there's a certain amount of larceny, and I've gone to place in Arizona, where the cheapest place you could rent is $750. And you'd be surprised how many of the people, they steal toilet paper, you don't dare bring your soap around, there's no one that goes there that can't afford to go. And they, in our town, we have a prison. And the new approach now is not to feel sorry for yourself that you came from a broken home and so on and so forth. And they, the psychologists tell them, it's up to you. It's your problem. You correct it or you stay here. And one of the other psychologists that was there, in a short, he said the thing to do is to throw them their first crime, throw them in the dungeon for 30 days and then let them out and tell them that you're going to, the next time you come in, you're going to get 90 days instead of 30 days. If you leave this person over that longer period of time, he gets accustomed to it and he cares less and he's very happy.
Well, let me say this, those elderly people that steal, or those people that steal that, those toilet papers and soap and so on, would you throw them in a dungeon for 30 days?
I would, if they were caught, I would throw them out of the place. Okay.
Well, that's certainly a possibility.
Well, let me finish my...
It's not a dungeon, though.
You can go back and tear them apart. The punishment system, have you ever studied the vigilante law in Montana? They corrected the problem. They just came out and hanged them. And they solved the situation. It really did. Drunken driving, in the state of Washington, there is less drunken driving than there has ever been since we throw them in jail for 1 week. And you go to Europe, and it's their laws, their scripture, and you find very few people driving. And I've known this, I've been in the food business, and people do, they're very cautious now. The consumption of alcohol is less, and this is because of drunken driving law. And the state of Washington is suffering from that. Well, let's see.
Can I respond to a couple of things you said?
Yeah.
Because I think maybe other people might want to, too.
I like the Japanese approach. I think it's good. And one of the things that I admire, the Mormon Church, and I propose all your people here, I'm not a Mormon, I'm a Lutheran, but I think that the problem of the Lutheran is that the Mormon Church has 5 people that they're responsible for, and they contact them, I think it's a short period, 5 minutes or so, 30. And if we had to, throughout our system, we would have, I think, less crime. And, I can see this drugs. One of the greatest drugs we have a community is coffee.
I don't think a lot of people could get through the day without it. Let me say a couple things. One, vigilante movements represent community control of crime. So I don't disagree with you there. I said vigilante movements represent an attempt at community control of crime. So I don't disagree with you that there. Who do you think the biggest lobby against that is, though? The criminal justice system itself, okay?
Well, you come out and you tell us something, that what should we do now? Give us something concrete we can work on.
Well, how about the idea that you just mentioned with the Mormons? Well, I don't know how they compare to other religious groups, but you're saying... See, people aren't just a member of a denomination.
Because the ones that aren't really educated. I think that your suggestion about community, though, and if we would all take time to get to know our neighbors and care and give them a call.
See, I sometimes like, at the school I teach, they build a lot of tract homes around that area. And I look at those as they're being built, and I say, you know, these are actually playgrounds for juvenile crime. Because all the homes are built so they're facing out like that with fences on the side, you know, so people live like what they have blinders on. And they just see the house across the street. And juvenile crime is rampant in those areas because it's so easy. You just go up to somebody's door and knock on it. If nobody answers, there's nobody home. You can break in. And if people do answer, you say, can Susie play? And they say, well, Susie doesn't live here. And so, I must have the wrong house. They arrest these juveniles, and they've committed like 400 burglaries. You know, it's just something to do after school. We're going to talk about this tomorrow when we talk about individual approaches. Yes?
I'm a substitute teacher at the high school, the junior high level. And, of course, we're facing public property. It's just rampant. Lockers or destroyed or writing or whatever it might be. Yeah. And in some of the middle schools, they've started the idea that the kids who have to party 3 times in class, they will go 3 hours just scrubbing lockers or scraping off the gum on the bottom of the chair. Well, at first everyone kind of poo-pooed and ha-ha'd, but there were three or four teachers in each school who said, this is important, and we will devote the time that it'll take for a Saturday school to come for 3 hours and help these kids learn how to scrub stuff off the floor. Well, not only have some of those teachers become really good friends with the kids who have been partying class or kids class or selling drugs out of the back alley, but also the kids have said, hey, listen, you're not going to ride on that locker because I scrubbed that last Saturday. And there has been a whole bunch of kind of peer support and even a community built among these kids who have been to Saturday school. And they found that there are not a whole bunch of repeaters. It has taken adult supervision.
That's right.
And without the idea of judgment on the kids, I mean, somewhere along the line, a rule was broken, you cut three times, or you were dealing in the back alley or something, and so you will be putting in time. But the person who has worked with them on the Saturday hasn't been standing there with a whip, even though the Lysol and so forth.
I think that that's true. We have to stop here, but if we're going to, see, it's taking responsibility. You know, it's like parents who say, okay, you have to be home at 12 midnight, but then the parents aren't there at 12 midnight, you know, or whatever. I mean, if you're going to hold people to something, you have to follow it through or it's not going to work. I think that's really an important point to make.